I want to welcome you to our investment strategy and performance update call. I'm here with Mike Miller from Colonial Consulting, and we'll be going over the investment results as of June, presenting the slide deck that you've received in your email. And then, as always, make sure you have, we have time throughout the presentation or at the end for questions. Feel free to jump in. And you have to ask people if you, at this point, I'm not sure if everyone's muted or not. If you aren't muted, please just make sure when you're on your side to keep the noise down because it does come through on our call. But we want to make sure everyone has a chance to hear what Mike has to say. So I'm going to turn this over to Mike and take it away. I'm sure we're going to have some really good, robust discussion throughout the presentation, but I'm sure there'll be questions at the end as the market continues to give us challenges, but not in the long run. So I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Deb. Good morning, everyone. Nice to be with you as always. As Deb said, I know you have the slide deck, but I thought I would start by just mentioning, needless to say, we live in unusual times, and at least in the narrow world of investing, one of the things that's particularly unusual this year is that we have had a pretty good stock market, I think it's fair to say, and at the same time, a pretty good bond market. And that's an unusual combination when interest rates are as low as they are, to have fairly large capital gains on bonds because rates have been falling, and not have the stock market go into an utter panic as a result. So it's just really quite interesting. And as you know, and I'll come back to this in a moment, one of our basic precepts is that we really don't know what markets are going to do in the short term, so we don't spend time trying to figure that out. We just look at what's happening, react to things that seem unusually interesting to us, and then otherwise go about our business of just trying to deploy your capital, Foundation's capital, wisely. And I'll define what that means in a moment. So why don't we start with the results, which are on slide 2. You can see here the three pools, long-term pool, socially responsive pool, and the midterm pool. And all three of them, with the exception of the year-to-date period, and actually a little bit in 3 years as well, so midterm, are outperforming their benchmarks. In the case of the long-term pool, you can see really robust premiums with the exception of calendar year-to-date. Last 3 years, up 9.4% per year net of fees, net of investment fees, I should say, versus the benchmark is up 8.3%. We list a simple 70-30 mix. We're not 70% invested in stocks, so that index is just there to show that we had just picked a simple mix of index funds. That's how we would have done. The custom benchmark reflects the mix over time weighted by market indices. I'll show you that mix in a moment. But needless to say, the pool is outperforming both of those measures by fairly healthy margins over time. And our primary goal, as you know, for perpetual capital, long-term capital, is to outperform CPI plus 5. You can see the numbers are out to 10 years well above that number. And 15 years, we've snuck back above it, thanks to the recent gains. And I'll remind you that 15 years includes the global financial crisis. And so kind of fascinating to think about all the years we had to sit behind that index on a long-term basis because of these big losses in the middle of the period. And now we've kind of recovered them all and then some. And so it's a satisfying outcome. It's particularly satisfying when you think that index funds, the 70-30 mix we have here on our custom benchmark, did not outperform CPI plus 5. So that's a really important, I think, testament to the Foundation's prudence over the years managing this portfolio. The socially responsible pool has been outperforming quite a bit recently, with the exception again of year-to-date, which I'll come back to in a minute, but has over 10 years just about matched its index, so we are continuing to strive to have the 3, 5, and 7-year numbers be more representative of performance, which is ahead of the indices. And last but not least, the midterm pool, which you can see is also underperforming year-to-date and has a small level of underperformance for 3 years, but is essentially matched for 5 years. The midterm pool is large in index funds, and there is some cash and some indexes that are a little more conservative in the markets, which is why it's underperforming recently. Now, the thing I just kind of jumped past and I want to come back to is why are we underperforming so far this year? The simple answer is that we have something that we always do here, which is we are very big believers in the idea that we should get paid to take on risk. And I know that sounds like something everybody would like to do, but the reality is if you don't worry about what you pay for security, you just own what's popular and what's working, you may not be actually getting that equation right. And so we're very focused on tilting the portfolio increasingly towards the areas where the markets are just pricing things too pessimistically, avoiding the areas where we think the markets might be being too optimistic in their pricing. And the problem with optimism, it's a wonderful thing in human being, not a wonderful thing in market pricing. Because when things are optimistic, disappointment is a very likely scenario, number one. And number two, prices tend to be too optimistic no matter how good the future might be. And so we're very focused on that. And that has cost us some returns so far this year. And I'm going to come back to a couple of things later that put some more meat on those bones, so to speak. But needless to say, that's how it's back. We actually, you may or may not agree, but we feel as though we've gotten close enough to feel really good given that we think a really great portfolio that has a lot of outperformance potential because of all the things I just mentioned. So with all that said, a little bit of underperformance this year. It's unusual in this portfolio, as you know, to underperform. Frankly, to be ironic for a moment or not ironic, I would be disappointed if we were outperforming because I'd be worried about the risks we're taking, frankly. I know that sounds a little weird to say, but needless to say, the formula that led to all the long-term success you see is the same formula we're using right now that's causing us some short-term pain. Let me just stop there and see if there's questions on the returns, because I don't want to jump past that if anyone has questions about that.
Mike, I think we're being muted remotely. Oh, right now.
Okay.
We'll keep on going.
No questions.
And then what we'll do is we'll unmute as soon as we can, and then we'll pause and ask the questions with getting that.
Okay.
I apologize.
No problem. Sorry, girl. I'll stop asking people the next question. If you turn to slide 3, here you'll see the rankings of the portfolio. And it's very important. So this is the Investor Force Endowment Foundation Index. It's about 850 endowment foundations around the country. And you can see that it's kind of we list the community foundation's return, which is the same number you saw on the prior page, and then we list the median return for the ENF universe. And what you'll see, which is interesting, is I've always, in past calls, I've mentioned that when we're outperforming our benchmarks, the benchmarks are not easy to outperform, and if we're doing that, we should be ranking very strongly compared to other endowments and foundations. And what you can see here is that formula is coming through loud and clear. We underperformed our benchmark, you saw on the other page, and we're underperforming the median as well, which put us in the fourth quartile. So that beige bar reflects which of the quartiles we're in, first being the top 25% and fourth being the bottom 25%. We don't like being in the bottom, to be very clear. With that said, again, we think we're going against the grain. And going against the grain is one of the things that everyone likes to say they're doing. But if you're really doing it, then you need to be willing to suffer some short-term pain. It wouldn't be against the grain if everybody was doing the same thing. So other people have a stronger allocation to U.S. stocks than we do. They have a stronger allocation to what I would call grossly overvalued stocks than we do. And we think that eventually, and maybe it might be happening as we speak, markets correct for that. And that's how you get back to where we are for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and 15 years, which is top quartile. And in fact, the 15-year number is actually top decile compared to other endowment funds around the country. So it's the same stories on the prior page. Short-term, a little less. Something we're not as proud of, but not really worried about because it's short term and we think it makes sense given what's happening in the markets, and long term there's some very, very powerful returns compared to benchmarks. We turn to slide 4. Very importantly, track records are nice things, but all they tell you about is the past. And the question is what happens in the future. And that's frankly what we spend 99% of our time worrying about. And the critical thing for thinking about the future is to have a strategy, especially when you've had success, that you can repeat. So slide 4 kind of gives you the three principal things that we think about. One is that we don't make short-term market calls. And so that top point, we maintain a mix of stocks, bonds, and some alternatives driven by each pool's objectives. And so we'll look at that in a moment for the different pools. But return objectives, risk objectives, and time horizon are very important components. Not do we think the market's going to go up or down? Do we think the election's going to go this way or interest rates going to go this way? We don't think about those things. And one of them is we just don't know. It'd be wonderful to know, but we don't. Second point, we'll talk about hedge funds a little later. We have private equity. We have hedge funds in these portfolios. Those are expensive vehicles, and they justifiably to receive a lot of attention, a lot of concern. And our view has always been the same, which is that fees are the enemy of performance. However, it can't be that absolute. It's got to be about being efficient with fees. So we will pay higher fees, but only to get something unique and special that we can't get for less. And so that's when we use the word deploy fee dollars efficiently. So fee minimization is one thing. Fee efficiency is another thing. And we've been very focused over the years on a combination of minimizing fees and making those fee dollars be efficient, with efficiency being the governing force there. And that's all those returns you've seen up to date are, again, net of those fees. And we understand the hurdle that fees create for us, but we also think that it's not a good thing. And last but not least, we think about risk. Returns are great. When you look at a 9% return per year over the last decade, it's really easy to get excited, but there's also a lot of risk over the last decade. As we all know, back in 2009, it wasn't so clear that we'd be sitting here today to where we are with, again, not the greatest economy in the world, so not the greatest of anything in the world, but markets that have been quite good. But risk is a critical thing for anybody. We'll come back to that in a moment. Slide 5 is a review of the three pools in terms of their asset mix. And you can see, I mentioned earlier, that the long-term pool is compared to a 70% stock mix. You can see it's only 52.5% in stocks. So those first six categories are equity categories or stock categories, and you'll see we break things out based on where managers fit in. Special opportunities, just so you know, that's not one that people run into that often, that refers to very concentrated, very high-octane equity strategies. So that's why we listen to the equity category, but we like to cordon them off because they are a little different than other things we use in the portfolio. And historically, they've been one of the critical issues in terms of adding value to returns. We have 52.5% in stocks in the long-term pool, 60% in the SR pool, and 47.5% in the midterm pool. Where you can see the difference in time horizon and opportunity set is in the bond side. We have 21.5% of the long-term pool in bonds, 30% in the SR pool. And that's probably because we don't do things like hedge funds in the SR pool, because there just really aren't a lot of good SR-oriented hedge funds out there, so we don't use that space. We also have less in private assets in the SR pool, so we drive that towards a little bit higher in stocks and a little bit higher in bonds, and that's how we answer that question. And last but not least, the midterm pool has 47.5% in bonds, which is some of that's in short-term bonds, which is the point I was making earlier about underperforming this year with interest rates falling as much as they have. But we have that high bond exposure in large part because what we're trying to do is, again, we're thinking about time horizon and volatility with that pool a lot more, because that those dollars that are in there are intended to be much more liquid and much more available to you as you need to distribute them in larger chunks, essentially. And then finally at the bottom, you can see 21% of alternatives in the long-term pool. That's hedge funds and private assets. We'll come back to hedge funds a little later. And 5% in the SR pool. And then, of course, last but not least, the Vermont investments at 5% as well, the emission investments that the portfolio has.
It sounds like we have people live on the line, so we can pause for a moment and see, are there any questions on what Mike just said or any of the previous slides? I want to give everyone participating a chance to ask. Okay. All right.
So, turn to slide 6. Lucky for me in Colonial, one of the questions we don't have to answer in the investment community later is, why don't we just put the whole thing into passive management or index funds? And the reason I want to answer that question, it won't be asked, is because the portfolio significantly outperformed index funds over its history, with the exception being, of course, the first 6 months of this year. So the question then becomes, how do you do that? How do you outperform over decades, in this case, or more than a decade, I should say? And the answer is that it's an incredibly skeptical process. It's a process that begins with the idea that managers are, by and large, not able to outperform indexes, that if you generalize about this industry, it's a failure. However, if you find the small number of really exceptional investors out there, you can outperform by enough to make up for your mistakes as a company or index fund positions, because we do own index funds as well. So the key rules are on slide 6 that Colonial has always followed. One, returns are always accompanied by risk. Okay, keep in that word risk. Risk is a big word, a really big word today, and I think a lot of people are unfortunately walking into a big trap, which we'll come to a little later. But returns are always accompanied by risk. And so when we look at managers and we look at investing, we don't try to find things about risk. We try to understand the risks we're taking and decide whether or not the compensation is worth it, number one. And number two, can we live with the risk? Risk can mean I'm going to underperform by a lot. Risk can mean I'm going to lose half my money. Risk can mean a whole bunch of different things. We're not good with losing half the money, so that isn't the risk we're willing to bear. We're willing to bear the risk of underperformance, though, when investing is being done in an appropriate way. Second point, we must understand the strategy, know the key personnel, and avoid needless complexity. A lot of the engineering that goes on, particularly today with factor models and indexes that are based on factors and all these other things, they're interesting, I guess, except the problem with them is they're complicated, they're messy, and we don't understand why they need to exist, frankly. And so we are very much of the school of thought that things should be simple. We own indexes, the very old, good old-fashioned cap-weighted indexes that are the cheapest and the best. Two, when we use active managers, those managers have to be people who do real research on real companies. They can't be buying a bunch of stocks and trading them all the time. We need to understand their strategy, look the people in the eye who make these decisions and make decisions about them and their portfolios, which we then bring back to the foundation. Third point, operational issues. This is a place we don't take risk. Must be an independent custodian, a credible auditor, outside administrator, which makes sure the assets are safe. That's a place you don't take risk in investing, and so there is a place we do avoid risk completely. And the last element is the forward-looking process. I'll give you an example without being specific. We have a manager today that we're committed to discuss whether to take out of the portfolio. This manager had an absolutely fantastic track record for us, but we think something may have changed in the firm that we're not happy about. It's not hurting their returns at all, but we're not interested in the fact that they've done well. We want to know what they're going to do next, and the caliber and the tenor of an organization helps decide that. So again, forward-looking process. We don't fire people because they've underperformed, and we don't keep them necessarily when they outperform. It has to be that the organization is one that we can continue to be patient with and trust, and that's a really important component for us as well. I will skip by slide 7. This is the nauseatingly long partial list of things that the team at Colonial looks at and thinks about all the time. And instead, ask you to turn to slide 8, where we think about our last point on managers, and then we'll get to hedge funds, and then we'll get to the markets as well. Manager success is built on three basic things here. One, a high bar. So every manager in this portfolio is expected to generate a lot of return. If we don't think we're going to get a lot of return, and we define that, by the way, 2% net of fees above the index for equity managers over long periods of time. If we don't think we can get that, then we're not interested. And the reason we're not is the point that we were talking about earlier. It's hard to be a success with active management, number one. Number two, even if you're good at this, and we think we are good at it, you're going to make mistakes. And when you make those mistakes, you need to have the stuff that works be good enough to overwhelm your mistakes, so to speak. And so that's been the struggle here all along. I can assure you, go back and look at the record here and how strong it's been. There were plenty of mistakes in that track record, and that's because that's we're humans, and that's we're going to do that. Unfortunately, we've done it, and we will do it, and we're doing it now. But nevertheless, we try to make sure the balance is right. Edge, we talked about a little before. The people that manage money for this portfolio must have an edge. And we can talk about it more if you have questions about that, but that's a really critical component. A lot of managers come to us and they have a good track record. They might even have a good story, but when you listen to how do they succeed, why will they succeed, it's very hard to convince yourself there's anything that they have that's special. And if they don't, then it's not interesting. We'd rather own the index. And last, and least, one more time on risk. We don't like risk. We like risks we're going to get paid for. We don't like risks that can be incredibly noxious in short periods of time, or that can be quite disturbing in terms of the balance. And so leverage is one. Destabilizing liquidity structures, i.e. if you're in a fund, that the securities inside that fund are not very liquid, but the fund also has liquidity investors, a classic problem. You can be subjected to a lot of really unforeseen, disastrous outcomes. We have no tolerance for that whatsoever. So now on slide 9, we always do this because the hedge funds are such a controversial part of the portfolio. And you can see here on slide 9, what we've done is we've plotted out for you the returns and the volatility of the hedge fund portfolio over time. So we started investing here in hedge funds in February 1st, 2003. This is a volatility versus return graph. So returns are the vertical scale, higher is better. And volatility, or the bouncing around, is the horizontal scale. As you move to the right, you have a more volatile portfolio. As you move to the left, you have a less volatile portfolio. As I'm about to show you in a minute, volatility and return, the way those intersect, has a huge impact on philanthropy and maximizing the impact of these dollars in the community. So it's not a question of, let me just maximize my returns. It's not a question of, let me control the risk. You have to get both right and in balance. So what you're looking at now is the diamond on the far right-hand side of the page is a 70% global stocks, 30% bonds index. We looked at that a little bit earlier, and you saw the portfolio outperforming it. The blue circle is the VCF long-term pool, again, and you can see that it's actually outperformed with about an 8% plus return per year over this 16-year-plus period. 16-year-plus period. It's had less volatility than the 70-30 mix. So that's partially because it's had less equities, and it's partially because of the things it also does within equities and the hedge funds. So fast forward a little bit over on this page. Now take a look at the yellow circle. That's the bond market, which has returned a stunningly good 4% per year. I'm not being sarcastic when I say that. That's a huge return and for bonds, particularly given how what growth would look like and what interest rates we would have thought would have been. But they're very low today, as everyone on this call knows, and it's created a lot of capital gains for bonds that, frankly, you know, may or may not. They're going to eventually go away, I suppose, but you know, someday, I guess. The orange circle under the line, that's an index of hedge funds. Those are not the Vermont Community Foundation hedge funds, to be clear. That's the HFRI Fund of Funds Index. That index, you can see, has returned 3% per year, and it's had more volatility than bonds. And so that's the reason when people say, why would you invest in hedge funds? That's the basis of the question, which is that the hedge fund industry is essentially, you know, the failure of active management in general is multiplied for hedge funds. And it's in part because the fees are even higher, the complexity is even higher, all the things that go wrong with decision-making and human beings go wrong in hedge funds times three. And so that's why you see that really awful result. The only defense of that orange circle, and I'm not really offering a defense, just to be clear, is that it's not that volatile. But again, like I said, you could have owned bonds, and even if the bond market returned 1% less per year, it still would have done just about the same as hedge funds, and it would have been a lot cheaper, a lot easier to understand, and a lot more liquid. So there's no defense for that orange circle whatsoever, and that's the experience of a lot of hedge fund investors. But the red circle is the VC, the Vermont Community Foundation's experience. As you can see, I mean, I'd like it to be better. I'm never happy with anything we do. But the Vermont Community Foundation portfolio returned about 6.5% per year, which is better than bonds, you can see. It's been more volatile than bonds, but it's dramatically higher, about 3%, 3.5% per year higher than the hedge fund index that we showed here. And that red circle is high enough in terms of its return profile to be part of the reason the blue circle has been dragged to the left the way it has. And so diversification is valuable as long as we don't pay too much for diversification vis-a-vis lower volatility and lower returns. Last thing, real quickly, the red circle is the actual returns of the Vermont Community Foundation portfolio since February 2003. Every bad manager, every good manager is in those numbers. It's not a cherry-picked group. It's the actual returns of that segment of the portfolio. Let me stop there before we switch gears and talk about balance and the markets and see if there's any questions so far. So I made this reference before, which is that a lot of times people who invest in endowment funds, there's two groups of people out there who want to oversimplify the world. There's the group that says, hey, I'm here to preserve purchasing power. I'm here to generate the highest long-term return I can. You know, that argument could lead you to be 100% in stocks, for example. And today, I think those of that mindset might even be 100% U.S. stocks, to be clear. Then there's another group out there which believes that, wait a second, volatility is a really big deal. I need to be careful about my short-term outcomes and my long-term outcomes, and I'm actually going to even sacrifice some long-term returns to make sure that I can sleep at night, keep my job. There's a whole variety of, you know, legitimate and not so legitimate reasons for dampening volatility. But the key point for us is that if neither is right, the right answer is about balance. And balance is having enough volatility, enough risk in a portfolio that you can generate a return that's actually very strong, but not too much volatility, as that leads you to a less successful outcome in general. So slide 11 is really important. What we're doing here is we said we want to try to illustrate this point about how volatility and return intersect in a portfolio. And it's a very, very significant point. So what we did is we said, let's take $1 million in March 31st, 2002. And we picked that date because that's actually when Colonial showed up on the scene here in Vermont. So that date is not a randomly selected date. It's the date we started. And the portfolio began to be changed towards our current approach. We took that $1 million, we invested it in one of three ways. We put it in either the VCF, the Vermont Community Foundation long-term pool. We put in a simple mix of 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And the stocks, just did the S&P 500, though we fundamentally disagree with the idea that all of your stocks should be in the U.S. But we did it here anyway because that index has been the strongest index. We want to make this point. And the gray bar, as you see on this page, is just 100% in stocks. So, very interesting. $1 million into each of those three portfolios. And the other thing we did is we said, let's take out 5% a year of a 20-quarter rolling average along the way, every year. Let's not add a nickel to this portfolio, and we will see what happens. So at the end of June of 2019, you can see that the portfolio, the fund that was left, again, after returns and after spending, had gained about $500,000 if it had been in the Community Foundation's long-term pool. If it had been in the 60-40 mix, it was about $350,000 less, so less. If it had been in the S&P 500, it was worth more. It was like $600,000. So for those who say, huh, see, I should have been 100% in stocks, that's what it looks like if you look at just those bars. But now take a look at the next set of bars, which is what went out of the portfolio over time. And you'll see the reason that the S&P 500 portfolio's ending fund balance is higher isn't because its returns are so much better. It's because less was spent. In fact, almost $200,000 less was distributed over time in the S&P 500 index. And you might say, why would it distribute less? And the answer is the volatility. So when the stock market falls 40% in 2008, even the 20-quarter average doesn't save you from having a very significant cut in spending, which, by the way, as I don't need to tell you on this call, could not occur at a worse time. We already have an economic and market disaster on our hands, and we're reducing the philanthropic impact of these dollars at the exact same time. It's kind of the definition of bad philanthropy. But needless to say, that's what happens. And then the last set of bars, it gets worse for the S&P investor. I'll show you in a minute. But the last set of bars just adds those first two together and just gives you this point I was making a minute ago, which is actually forget about returns, forget about volatility. Let's talk about dollars, because dollars are ultimately what matter to any investor, or should. The philanthropic throughput of being in the pool is actually higher, much higher than the 60-40 mix, and even higher than just being in the S&P 500 alone. By the way, during a time when the S&P 500 has actually done pretty well. It did have the 2008 crisis, but the last 10 years have been magnificent for the S&P. So we're not picking a point of weakness to do this analysis on the S&P. So now turn to the next page, slide 12, which just tries to give you a little more insight to this point, which is not just about the returns. So the Vermont Kennedy Foundation portfolio did not keep up with the S&P 500 over this period of time. It actually underperformed it by just under 12%. That's cumulative, so not 12% per year, to be clear. So 12% less return when you just measure rates of return. And if you stop the analysis there, you might say, I should have been in the S&P 500. But then if you look at philanthropic impact, which again is the growth in the fund balance plus spending, so this isn't some squishy risk-adjusted thing. These are dollars, dollars, dollars. 4.5% more dollars that's spending plus the change in fund balance than the S&P 500. So that's about a 17% swing. If you think about a 16.5% swing, that's pretty interesting. And actually, I wouldn't even concede that 11.9% sustainable. I look at the market financial portfolio outperforming the S&P for the next 10 years. But putting that aside, that's the first thing we have to go through. Secondly, we didn't show you the return because the Vermont Key Fashion Pool did outperform the 60-40, but we did show you the philanthropic impact was actually 19% in that case. So for the S&P investor, it's okay. I still don't need to have your pool all of a sudden some bonds to dampen the volatility, so that didn't work out so well either. Slide 13 gives you one more, I think, very damning picture for the all-equity portfolio, even the 60-40 portfolios. So here what we've done is we've taken those bars in the middle of slide 11, the total spending bars, and we plotted them out year by year. And you can see in the beginning all three, the lines of correlates with the other lines. So the blue line is long-term pool, the orange line is the 60-40, and the gray line is the S&P. You can see in the beginning on the left-hand side of the graph, the S&P line plunges quite a bit. That's because we were still picking up the 2002 bear market right at the beginning there, if you remember. Some of us are old enough to remember. The blue line goes down too, by the way. We have stocks in this portfolio. It does suffer at times. But if you look at that trend, the first thing that's interesting is that blue line, even with the global financial crisis, really doesn't drop very often. And it keeps its shape, so to speak. And it tends to head higher, which is the point of inflation-adjusted spending, right? Because there has been inflation during this time. Not much, but there's been some. The orange line is a little less of a disaster when it comes to dropping all the time, but it doesn't go up nearly as much as the Community Foundation pool because it's just not as high returning a portfolio. So adjusting the risk without getting return is not a great outcome. And then the gray line is the S&P. And you can see actually, you know, frankly, what's really interesting, if you think about it, it started at $50,000 back in 2002. It didn't get back to actually distributing $50,000 again until 2016. So 14 years of waiting to get back to where you started with an S&P investment and this strategy is really pretty disturbing, I have to say. And that doesn't mean that ignores the other points I made a minute ago about having spending dropping during a financial crisis, which is clearly not a good idea. Any questions on that so far? Okay, so I was offering up a set of reasons, some might say excuses, for our underperformance to begin this year. And so I want to try to put a little bit more meat on those bones, like I said. So if you turn to slide 14, this is a chart, which I'll come back to in a minute, but you have a word at the top, fear. A manager actually was in this portfolio today using their last letter term, which we really love, which is that the world right now is experiencing, the capital markets are experiencing a fear bubble, it was described as. And it's an interesting term, and it's fascinating in lots of ways, and the best way to illustrate this point is to look at what's on slide 14. So this is the value of all negative yielding debt around the world, which is actually just north of $14 trillion. I think it's even a little higher today. This is, I think, through June or July of this year. So what's a negative yielding bond? Let's first of all just define that term for everybody. So normally you own a bond, you have a positive rate of interest, which means that if I borrow money from debt, for example, I have to pay the interest. That's kind of a logical concept. Negative yielding bonds are the opposite, which is that I actually get to borrow money from Deb and she pays me to use her money. And if that sounds insane to you, it's because it is. But nevertheless, there's so much fear out there. There's so many computer trading programs out there and there's so much momentum out there that interest rates have been dropping and it creates gains and it attracts more dollars to the gains and more dollars to the gains. And it's gotten to the point we've driven the value of bonds to levels where the yields are negative for government bonds largely in many parts of the world. The United States doesn't yet have negative yields. Let's hope we don't. But needless to say, $14 to $15 trillion of bonds have negative yields today. And I'm going to make a big stink about this to point out that that's a great definition of a fear bubble because it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever economically to pay somebody to use your money. But that's what we're essentially saying. And that's what we have. So that's a really interesting point. The second part about it, which is on slide 15, is this fear bubble is not limited to the bond market. It's affecting the stock market, too. And as we look at the markets, and I'll show you a slide in a moment that illustrates this, the disparity in valuations between really good companies that might have negative macro issues, I'll talk about that in a minute, or might be in industries that aren't loved, there might be some fear of a disruptive company coming in, or anything that is remotely negative, some of these companies are trading at prices that are just mind-boggling cheap, and they're not even very risky businesses, to be clear. Very, very unlevered to non-levered balance sheets, high free cash flow generation, very stable, safe businesses in many ways, maybe a little cyclicality, and people hate these things. They hate them so much they've driven the prices to levels that just make absolutely no sense whatsoever. And at the same time, people love certain businesses like consumer staple companies, some tech businesses until recently where the valuations were just mind-bogglingly high. It's really fascinating. So first point, valuation disparities, which by the way, that's what we get up every morning looking for. So let's find valuation disparities, because that's the market being short-sighted usually, and long-term investors like the Community Foundation can take the other side of that all day in a diversified way. Second point, a lot of this rationale for why are some businesses trading at such bad levels or low levels, it's not because of the businesses, it's because either the industries, I guess, that might be controversial, and I don't mean like controversial, shouldn't exist kind of controversial, I mean a cyclical business, for example, in Europe is controversial today because, oh my God, Europe has problems, Brexit's occurring. My point is there's a lot of one-dimensional thinking out there. You can't simplify hundreds of stocks or whole industries by using the word Brexit. There's much more analysis required, but a lot of investors just aren't doing that. And it led to a really fascinating problem for us, and I warn everyone on the phone, if you're looking at managers and you see somebody who's doing really well right now, it might be because they're really good, or it might be because they're just in the right place at the right time. I play in my career, I can only think of a few times where we've met more incompetent people with great track records than today. It's fascinating, and it's very disturbing, and we have to be very careful with that. And the opposite also holds. We've met some really brilliant people with awful track records right now, and it's really quite interesting to figure that out and try to decide who it is. Slide 16 is meant to kind of give you some perspective on this point. And the sense at the top, does price matter anymore? That's sarcasm, by the way. Price always matters in investing. It doesn't matter in the short term. People get to pretend it doesn't for a little while, but then eventually they pay the price for that, unfortunately. And again, back to our record here, the Community Foundation record, price is always matter. The Community Foundation, that's how we invest, because that's, by the way, the definition of investing is thinking about price. There's no other definition. This chart, though, essentially takes the most expensive and the cheapest quintiles of the U.S. stock market and plots them all the way back to 1951. And what's interesting, you can see the cheapest quintiles, so these are the companies, by the way, some of these companies at the bottom are garbage businesses, to be clear. We're not suggesting that all cheap stocks are great businesses. I'm just saying from earlier, some really great businesses are very cheap today. That's just because of the world we live in. But that doesn't mean it's always the case. And you can see those levels of valuation are pretty consistent over time. it's the popularity of the cool stuff that is so interesting to watch. So, for example, I was a young man, I was actually a child, but if you look to the far left-hand side of the page, you can see kind of the 1970s nifty-50 type market where valuations got very high for the green line, that very popular expensive stuff. Happened again in the late 80s before the crash in 87, which I wasn't a go for. Then you get to the 1999 bubble, the CMT bubble, and we've drawn a red arrow. The red arrow that goes to the left and down, that's the valuations of those stocks in the 90s. And then look where we are today. The 1990s thing looked like nothing by comparison. It's just fascinating. Now, I will say in all fairness, some of that 1990s bubble were really, really awful businesses that should never have been valued like that. The crop of businesses that are near the top today, at least some of them, are actually pretty good businesses, but they're still not worth 80 times earnings, to be clear. And that's a lot of that is software as a service businesses and stuff like that that's in that top group. But the only thing part of this graph is so interesting is that look how high the expense stuff is today. And that's this valuation disparity we're talking about. That's why I will admit, licking our chops a little bit.
And do you find that some of this is happening because of the accessibility and more people having the electronic access to investing? And, versus like back in the day, it might be more driven by professionals and what they're doing, and now you have people who are sitting there doing it at their desk, and they're like a me kind of person. Is that driving some of this almost over-inflated valuation because people just keep on buying because someone else bought, and therefore it must be good, and it just keeps on rising up the demand for it? I mean, what, beyond some of the things we talked about, is there some just inherent in the systems that we have now that will make this be another factor why it's so high?
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting question, Deb. So it's actually not individual investors who are doing this. The individual investors are fascinating. If you look at, I don't have any charts here, I'm afraid, but if you look at the flows, individual investors have been pulling money out of the stock market almost nonstop for 10 years, which is fascinating. And I got other calls years ago, I think I used to show that as a good sign that people are probably too nervous. This chart here is actually the professionals. They are, it's funny, and I try to make sure we don't ever do this, but sometimes if you're having success, it's really easy to convince yourself that you know a lot more than you do. And so I think a lot of professional investors today, as a group, not all of them, of course, are very enamored with these businesses, and they've been taught the lesson. If you think about that green line taking off where it has the last few years, the lesson to you is if you're a professional investor, you happen to own a tech stock, or two, or three, is that if you sold it because you were worried about its price, you were wrong. At least that's how it feels right now because the stock kept going up. So professional investors have kind of gotten sucked into that. That's one thing. That's a segment of it, to be clear. The second related point, which is the structural point that you're making, which I want to accentuate, is the level of computer trading out there is it's not insignificant. So the marginal prices of stocks are absolutely affected by algorithmic trading. There's a lot of fancy words for AI and machine learning and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, there may be, again, I'm actually a technical type person, so I'm not being disrespectful to the whole AI community by any means. I think that some of this is really cool stuff. However, when you boil it all down to the way it's affecting markets today and the way it's being applied, at least, it's basically momentum, chasing after what's working. And that's what you're also seeing in these numbers. So it's professional investors who've been taught the wrong lesson, frankly. And it's the computers and the momentum that naturally takes hold of them as well. So that's the thing that really caused this.
Interesting.
So now we have our problem, if I may, on slide 17. What is the Vermont Community Foundation to do? We see this massive valuation disparity. I'll try to make the case one more time a little later that we have this amazing portfolio of great investors who really are thoughtful about valuation and actually do own, by the way, growth stocks. We're not opposed to owning good companies. Let's be very clear. We own some very good companies, but they're not priced for perfection. So what do you need to do? I mean, do we just basically back up the chart and load up as much of these cheap, mispriced stocks, and we could, if we were doing a lot of hedging, which we're not, short sell all the really expensive stocks and just wait? The reason that is not a good strategy. And the reason it's not is once the laws of physics don't apply here. The fact that prices have gotten completely out of control doesn't mean they're about to come back down to earth. They might be as we speak, or they might not be. We could be having this exact same conversation 3 years from now, and we could be even worse. And we're very focused here on creating a balanced strategy. We don't want to put us or any of you on this call in the position of having to decide whether the Vermont Communications lost it or not, because we missed out on some massive market gain, even if it's ephemeral and foolish. So what we try to do is not do foolish things, but keep balance in place. And so that's the first point, is make sure we're balanced. Make sure the portfolio has good index funds. Make sure we're looking at managers who have growth mindsets, and they're not just looking at cheap companies because they're cheap. Make sure we have balance, because balance is the key. Second point, with the balance in mind, we also don't want to miss, I would argue, for those of you who like baseball, one of the fattest pitches you will see in the investment business is being delivered right now to us, and we don't want to miss that. And 3 years from now, when the markets probably will have come to their senses, and there's huge differences in performance between smart investors and other investors, we want to be in the smart investor group. So we're not going to miss this opportunity. We're also not going to bet the farm on it either. Third point. A lot of people have forgotten about price, and they're going to suffer. And I will tell you, I feel bad, because they really shouldn't have to, because these lessons have been taught time and time again. I will say there was about 2 weeks ago, when the markets have seemed to have shifted gears here recently, there was a huge article somewhere I saw about how disturbing it was to see the violent reversal in stocks, from growth stocks selling off and tech stocks selling off 20-25%, and value stocks, quote unquote, coming back so strongly. And you know, part of me wanted to say, well, it's like, that's not actually disturbing. That's called rational thinking. But it's disturbing to you if you don't understand investing. And so violence, reversals are what happens when you're making mistakes, essentially. And then the last point, which is really important, we have a political season that's obviously already begun. Between Brexit, between the U.S. elections, I can go on and on and on about all the things going on, the trade wars, et cetera. There's a lot of noise out there. And the thing that I think I've kind of preached to everyone on this call before, which I really want to emphasize again, is while we would love to know how this is going to turn out, we're hoping it's all turn out fine, the fact is that we don't know, and we can't make it part of our investment strategy. And in fact, what we should be doing, which is what we are doing, is when the bad news hits, do we have people who know how to pick through the rubble and buy the companies that are going to survive and even thrive in difficult times, and pick them up at really, really low prices? And that's why I wrote this word, bad news, or phrase, delivers asymmetric opportunities. Asymmetric in English means the risk of loss is very, very small because the prices are too low, they're too good, and the risk of huge gains is actually quite high. So last point, that I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, is on slide 18. This has always been the game changer all along. We're always consistent with our risk exposure. So when the portfolio is rising in value a lot and our equities are soaring, we're selling stocks and we're rebalancing the portfolio. When the equity market falls heavily like it did late last year, we're adding stocks and rebalancing. And it's not a view of what's going to happen next. It's a simple, be consistent. And that's a very valuable argument. And if you think about the last 10 years and the big gains this portfolio's had, it wasn't because we could see the future and we said, oh, things are going to be fine for the next 10 years. Let's not worry about anything. Let's just go right into our long-term strategy. It wasn't that at all. But we have a long-term strategy. We're going to stick to it. And it might be very uncomfortable at points in time, but we're okay with that too. Second point, volatility and emotion, which there's plenty of that out there. There will be more. Those are our assets, and we know that. And we take the other side of that all day in a diversified way. And last but not least, the foundation has hundreds of millions of dollars to invest, which gives us access to investors that, as smaller investors, most of us don't have. And that group, that scale, and the foundation's patient, long-term approach are extremely valuable at all times, but particularly at times where people are really, really nervous. So let me stop there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about the portfolio, the markets, or anything that I'm qualified to answer a question about, which is not very much, I'm afraid.
Mike, this is Tom Levitt of the Echo Leahy Center Board, and I have a question from our investment subcommittee. Can you hear me?
Yes, Tom, I hear you. Great. Thank you.
Great. The investment statements are only issued on a quarterly basis, and they cut about 30 to 40 days out from the end of each quarter. With the higher market volatility and some of the questions we get in our discussions in committee, has the VCF or Colonial considered issuing monthly statements or issuing the quarterly statements a little closer to the end of each quarter?
Actually, I can take the bonus of Debbie. So what you'll find is that we do issue a monthly update. So every month we will issue a performance update on each of the pools that Mike has been discussing. And that does get posted to the donor central portal so that any fund holder of the VCF can go and see the monthly update and use that as an estimate or as a visibility of how the portfolio is being done, the performances of the portfolio. In addition, just to kind of connect the dots, I know that you know, the 30 days does seem like a long time, and we are looking at that internally to make sure that we are being as efficient in getting our data back out to our fund holders as possible. As Mike has been showing here, our investments are not in an index or mutual fund. They're in limited partnerships and other structures that we are waiting for data from those partnerships as well. So we have talked about internally, should we do it on a month lag? Should we keep it to 30 days? And so we're still noodling on what the most effective way of doing that is. Our goal is to give the most current returns in the most timely fashion with the data we have. So if there's an interest of the monthly information, you can get that on the Donor Central portal. And as we continue to look for efficiencies and, you know, critically review our reporting process, we will update you as well. But that's a really good question, and we are, you know, looking at that internally as well to try to turn that around faster. Hopefully that gives you a little more insight of where you can get the data. And if you want, more than happy to talk offline as well.
Thank you. That does, and the information in this presentation has been helpful.
Great. Good.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Joy Fakus. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hi. I'm with the Vermont Humanities Council on the board, and I just have a question really around the socially responsive pool, and I understand on slide 7 you had a pretty extensive list of things that you would add in manager evaluation. What additional considerations do you have when you're looking at managers for the socially responsive pool, particularly with respect to proxy voting records and corporate engagement practices?
Yeah, that's a great question.
You start and I'll fill in.
Yeah, so the Proxy Foundation, I think this is published, has a values framework.
We do have a values framework. I'm not sure it's actually on the website, and so this is me again. So just, I'll frame a little bit and then Mike, you fill in. So really good question on the socially responsible pool. This is something that we've had since 2006, I believe, and we have been putting this through a more current review over the past few years to better align it with our overall goals of the SR pool, and then also to get our managers, of course, aligned with that framework. So the past few years we've been doing this, and we've been shifting our managers to be in better alignment. What we haven't done, I think, is, and we're going to be looking at this again, so doing some internal reflection of how we can improve, we are going to be sharing out information on the SR pool framework in a more detailed way in the near future. But the framework that we're using is what we're using to assess not only our current managers, but any of our future managers. And, Mike, I'm going to pause when you jump in there, and then I can add from there.
And actually, one thing I loved about the way you framed that question was the slide 7 is the basis for the socially responsible pool managers as well. But we add on, like Debbie said, is this aligned with the values framework that we want, or the set of specific values that are reflected there? I'm going to get to your corporate governance and proxy voting in a minute. We also actually are very focused on making sure the organizations that manage money in the social responsible pool are actually not just offering an investment product, but are actually true believers in responsible investing, which leads to your question, I think, which is that most are very active in being engaged shareholders. So they're focused on corporate governance, number one. Number two, voting proxies is amongst the things they do to be active shareholders. Another being filing shareholder resolutions in some cases, participating with other shareholders in movements to improve governance, improve the social qualities of these businesses. So there's a lot of different aspects of that. There's actually more than I can probably get into on the phone, but the point is that there's a very purposeful approach being used. And actually, when the investment committee and Dan look at new managers of the pool, we rank them and score them on various metrics around the things I just mentioned, so we can get a sense of whether we're pushing the pool quantitatively, at least from a admittedly a subjective set of judgments, towards a better pool that's more reflective of the community foundation's values, and also without compromising, to be clear, on investment returns, because you know we want that pool to be highly competitive in that regard. So there's a lot going on there, and I'm only scratching the surface.
And I'll add a little bit there too. You mentioned proxy voting and shareholder activism. We do have a proxy voting goal that we share with our investment managers. Now, since we don't own the stocks directly, we won't sometimes have the ability to vote proxies under our own signature and our name, but we share that with the managers of what we aspire them to be like. When we have the opportunity to do that, we will vote the proxies in alignment with our SR framework. In addition, as we bring on new managers, if we do have a separate account, like with Aperio, where we actually can have a voice of how things will be said and how the proxies will be voted or the shareholder activism, we are proactive on that. And we are actually having a call with Aperio over the next week to look at how they are actually voting the proxy votes that are available over the past few months we've invested with them, as well as how they're doing some shareholder activism that we can be more proactive with. So, great question. We have been doing this for a little while, SR Pool for a long while, refocusing the attention on the alignment, making sure all our managers are meeting the criteria, looking at ESG, environmental, social, and governance strategies, as well as the active side of the proxy voting and shareholder activism, which is limited to what we actually own, but when we're owning it, we want to actually have a proactive stance on it. So the reporting side of this, too, is something that we're aspiring to share with our bondholders. Again, building the infrastructure and collecting the data is something that we're working on, but hopefully in the near future we'll be getting something exciting out to everyone that they can see how we are implementing this as our strategy. And again, if there's more detailed questions, we can go offline, too, after the call or later this week.
Great. Thank you so much.
Any other questions? That was a great question. Thanks for engaging and asking the questions, and looking forward to sharing information with you on things as they continue to evolve here. And at any time, feel free to contact myself, Debbie Dabrowski, or David Morrissey, both of us at the BCF. And obviously, we're always in communication with Colonial Consulting and Mike Miller throughout the process. So our next call, I believe, is in December. We'll be sending you guys a reminder coming up. These calls are also saved on our website, both the slide deck and the audio. Feel free to share it with other people that you think it might be helpful to. And thank you so much, and enjoy the foliage season in Vermont. It's starting to really turn beautiful, so get out there and enjoy it. Thanks so much for being on the call.